This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Edward Humes here in the studio. May I call you Ed?
Yes, you may. Ed. And thank you. I'm happy to be here in your government issue chair.
Oh, thank you. Exactly. It's a lovely green,
yes.
Isn't it?
It's actually kind of sickly.
Totally. But somehow still, to me, heartwarming. I don't know.
Well, it's warming something.
It's what, yeah. Exactly. Well, I should say we're taping this program. It's September 25th, 2025, and you're in town with the Institute for the Humanities to give a talk. And we've got could I have your book for the moment?
Yep.
So we've got on the table with us today, folks, Total Garbage: How We Can Fix Our Waste and Heal Our World, the latest book out from Pulitzer Prize winning author Edward Humes. It's out with Avery, which is an imprint of Penguin Random House. And it's a lovely book. It's like, it's good to hold in your hands. Although the cover it's a lot of plastic on the cover, isn't it?
Yes, the cover is lovely aesthetically and horrifying in its actual content.
I mean, how much control did you have over like the look of what the book would look like?
I literally selected the art and consulted on everything else on the cover.
So. That's so great. So you meant to be horrifying.
Yeah.
When Shonda handed me this book, I was, Shonda is our guest audience today from the Institute for the Humanities, and we've got Frank Uli behind the glass engineering. When I saw this, I was thinking, the plastics can feel very overwhelming, and I love how we step into the book with you. You pack some punches in early, but then the experience of reading this is of uplift, of people doing work, of finding a way, and practical things that we can all do. So thanks for putting this together, I guess.
Well,
Ed.
And thank you for saying that the book is uplifting in some ways, because that was my goal. I mean, you know, if you're going to write a book... First of all, I should say, what possessed me, I'm not sure, to write two books, not one, but two, with the word garbage in the title.
Well, because Garbology was the first one, and that was, did you coin that?
No, actually, that is a word that was coined by the archaeologist turned garbologist, Bill Rathje, difficult name to pronounce. He was a professor in Tucson, and he... launched the Garbage Project, where basically he wanted to do archaeology for the recent past by excavating landfills.
Oh.
Which, you know,
so
actually
smart.
Trash piles have long been archaeological gold mines. Just not that recent.
That's right. Where, like, these beautiful ceramic pots are just from a long time ago in some of the other digs across the world or here in, yeah.
So that book was a narrative about what we throw away. And then I realized that that's only a small little slice of the waste pie in terms of how we live. And so I had thought for a long time about if I would ever write a trashy sequel to my first trashy book. And I decided that, and my publisher agreed, that one that looked at the wider world of waste and how that, oddly enough, once you realize that we're the most wasteful civilization in history, it empowers you to solve environmental problems that otherwise seem unsolvable.
And when you say we, do you mean...
Americans.
That's what I was just going to
say. We are the world champion wasters, for sure.
Champions!
We are the wasters. Yeah. That sounds horrifying, but waste is really something... one of the few things everybody can agree is a universal bad. You know, there's no yay waste political chorus out there. And when you can reframe something like climate change as basically a symptom of waste, which is exactly what it is, it changes the dynamic, and it's the big tent approach to solving environmental problems. And I found examples all over the country, red and blue state America, where that's being used as a way to bring people together and solve problems.
And that's how you go through the book. You bring us, like, the book is in three sections and all with great titles, lots of humor, which is evident from just talking with you these first couple of moments, Ed, where you're like, a trashy sequel to my like, it's just that spirit is also throughout Total Garbage, which is clear and present in the title itself. It's funny, but it's also horrifying and sad, that phrase, total garbage. Yeah. But through the book, you find people, their stories, you tell, like, you let the narrative kind of guide the way. And then there's some things that we can do, that we can learn from, like Owen's List.
Yeah. Yeah. Owen's List. You want to?
Yes, please. Would you tell us about it?
So that is one of the chapters set in Seattle, which is, you know, famous for being a very green city and very interested in it, in protecting its beautiful natural environment. But one thing they're struggling with, like the rest of the country, is recycling and keeping things out of the landfill and reusing and repurposing rather than, you know, just throwing stuff away. We are really bad at recycling, and most people don't realize that most of what we put in the recycling bin doesn't actually get usefully recycled, and that's particularly true of plastics. So Owen's List started as a father and son project in Seattle, and like a lot of people, I'm sure, who will listen to this, certain things got squirreled away in the house that nobody knew what to do with. And in the case of Ryan Metzger, father of Owen, he had a big drawer with a bag full of batteries.
I'm
old
familiar.
Batteries. Yeah. What do you do with batteries? You're not allowed to put it in the trash can. You can't put it in the recycling bin. There is supposedly a hazardous waste place where you can take them, but first of all, you have to figure out where that is, and then you have to take them there, and it's just easier to squirrel the stuff away and save it for another day. But one day, Owen comes home from school, and I believe he was 7 years old at the time, and he said, "Dad, we were learning about recycling today, and what I found this in the drawer," and he holds up this big bag of batteries. It's like, you know, weighing them down. And his dad says, "Well, you know, they're batteries, and I'm not sure what we're supposed to do with it." And Owen says, "Well, what's going to happen to them?" And, you know, little boys have a way of putting their dads on the spot. And so he says, "Well, let's make a couple of calls." And he makes some calls, and he finds out from the trash collection agency where batteries should be taken. And he said, "All right, let's do it. Let's take them and get these batteries recycled." He called, he found out the place didn't just dump them or do something bad to them. It actually repurposed these batteries and sent them to a place where the useful parts would be recycled in a meaningful way. So great. And as they're leaving, he thinks to ask his neighbors, "Hey, you guys got any old batteries? We'll take them back for you too." And his neighbors on both sides, "Yeah,
because this was on Queen Anne, right, in Seattle."
Yes, I think Queen Anne in Seattle. Yeah. And so anyway, they take the batteries back and drop them off, and Owen and his dad felt so good about this that they decided to make it an ongoing father-son project of bringing problematic stuff that they had squirreled away in the house or they weren't sure what to do to a place that would deal with them, like styrofoam and old eyeglasses and you name it. They kept thinking of things. What do you do with old Christmas lights? And can anybody use those? They would always ask the neighbors if they could take their stuff too when they figured out what their They do it once or twice a month, what they were going to be taking back. And then they turned it into an email list because more people kept asking, hey, can we send you our stuff? And they said, sure, we're gonna start sending out an email once or twice a month and say, on such and such a day, we're picking up your styrofoam waste or your plastic film, or your old baggies, because they cannot be recycled either conventionally. But there are places that will take them and use them. And Owen's list became very popular. It spread from the neighborhood all over Queen Anne and then the rest of Seattle. It was a big deal. The West Seattle Blog, it's the major news organ in West Seattle, where my wife and I lived for 3 years. We were very excited when Owen's list came. This is before I was working on the
book. To West Seattle,
yeah. Yeah, to West Seattle. And people were excited. But it was getting out of hand. And people started asking Ryan, hey, I feel bad that you're doing this just for free. Can we give you some money? And he said, no, that's not why we're doing this. But after a while, a few people suggested to him, his original customers, hey, maybe we could turn this into a business and really fill this gap that the conventional municipal waste system isn't dealing with. And they thought about it and said, well, why don't we try it and see what happens? And they changed the name to Ridwell, which really tells you exactly what the business is about. And Owen's List transformed into, it's not a nonprofit, but it is a corporation organized around a social good. And there's a special tax category for that. And what it does is the investors know that the main goal isn't just to be financially viable, but to fulfill the mission. And that is paramount. So Ridwell started in Seattle, and it did well. In some neighborhoods, they got 20% of the zip code to subscribe. And that's really big. It wasn't expensive. It was like the price of a couple three lattes every month to get twice a month pickups of a designated kind of waste. And this thing has taken off because after Seattle, it has spread. They're in 8 different states and growing, and they're all over Washington and Oregon. Apparently, people are willing to a point to forego those couple lattes and pay to have this waste dealt with responsibly. Now, it's kind of crazy that our system of municipal waste collection just doesn't do this, but we are really bad. We have this supply chain that businesses work on, like Walmart and all these logistics companies, that their supply chains are so efficient but make money for the companies, but our removal chain sucks. We just are badly organized and bad at finding places for useful material to stay useful. And Ridwell fills that gap.
And sometimes it feels like you might think you're doing something by putting it in the at least here, it's like the blue bin, the recycling
right.
bin. But what you're saying is so much of it isn't.
Only about 9% of our plastics get recycled. And there's certain things that we put in the recycling bin, like the kind of plastic that yogurt tubs are made out of. And there's only one place in the entire country that actually recycles that material. It can't take everything. So it all ends up in the landfill. We used to send it to China until 2018. Half, 50% of what you put in the recycling bin was actually not recycled. It was just exported to China for some recycling, but a lot of irresponsible waste disposal and ocean pollution, plastic pollution created. And it was kind of a scam that the public thought they were doing one thing and actually something really negative for the environment was happening instead. And then finally, China said, we have a growing consumer economy. We don't want your stuff anymore. And plus, your stuff is the worst. It's always dirty and low quality. And we just took it because we needed it before for our growing industries, but no more. So in 2018, they cut us off and our recycling industry collapsed. It had been artificially propped up with high prices for material that nobody else wanted. And now nobody wants. So we've been struggling ever since.
And so this is really grim, Ed. like what we're talking about right now. But one of the things that, like a glimmer in there that you also mentioned, was this repurposing. So there's like different ways that our waste can be addressed, you know, like, and you mentioned that even with Owen's List, they found places that even though the plastic baggies couldn't be recycled, there was a place that would repurpose them. Or,
well, they use a technology to convert it into another less disposable product. But, you know, so most people don't have Ridwell. There's a limited number of businesses where you can send this material to. So it solves part of the problem, but we consume many more disposable plastics than we could possibly put to use. So the solutions that that I highlight in the book, and there's no environmental problem mentioned in there that I also don't present a solution that's actually being done somewhere.
That's part of the hopeful part too.
Yes, that is the hopeful part. Yeah. But first, you have to be aware of just how much of this stuff we're making, and disposability is the fake convenience. You know, it seems like it's convenient, but only if you don't take into account how much it's costing us, and the costs are enormous. And you know, who pays for the willy-nilly use of disposable by corporations and how they're crafting their products and their packaging with no thought to their end life? Taxpayers do. We get stuck with the bill one way or another.
And the future.
So that cost of convenience is much higher than the accounting ledger takes account of. And so it's surprisingly easier than you may think to really cut your consumption of disposable plastics. And there's self-preservation involved here, because one of the things, you know, again, the horrible part of the book is kind of in the beginning when I talk about, well, we're all consuming like a credit card's worth of plastic every week.
Yes,
and it's really not health food. So
that's a shock. That's felt like such a shock, such a good way to put it. And
5 grams of plastic a week is what the average American is consuming now, because it's in everything.
And that's about a credit card.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know the idea of making our credit cards disappear made me sound like a good thing, but not in our guts. So
yeah, and not to chew it up and then swallow
it. Well, we don't. It's microparticles, so we're not aware of it.
It's in the water.
It's in the water. It's from us washing our clothes. It's from irresponsible disposal of all the plastic we generate. It's actually, if you must buy a disposable container, really you should do anything but plastic, whether it's metal, aluminum, anything. Because if you drink a bottle of water, bottled water in plastic, you will drink 100 times the amount of plastic you would otherwise consume with tap water. So you're mainlining the plastic every time you drink out of that stuff.
It's so what we're doing to the world. It's so hard. Sometimes it seemed like plastic bottles of water was the only like safe water to drink for some people for some time here
Very
in Michigan.
Very few people in the U.S. because most municipal water supplies are really excellent, and most bottled water is somebody's municipal water supply. They just stick it in a bottle. It's not like like from some magical spring somewhere.
Oh, completely. I guess I was thinking of like more locally, like Flint, Michigan.
Yes.
And we have some water pollution happening more close to home with PFAS, and but I think it just stops you in your tracks when you think, like when you were talking about convenience, Ed, to say then there's this thing that won't biodegrade and that will just be around forever. Like you use it for like a second to deliver something that you eat or drink or so you just, and then that second is over, and you're not thirsty anymore. You're not as hungry anymore, but then this thing just goes somewhere and just is, and it's just piles upon piles. And if you think about the exponential, that's what this book does too. Like you do get in there with some of the exponential factors and facts and numbers and some graphs, some more confusing than others. One of them I was like, what? and which is, I think, so important, especially because you have these stories that actually are slowing down and showing it in the real, in people's lives as well. I'll tell you what, let's, now that I've been going on for a while, let's take a short break and then we'll come back. Today on Living Writers, Edward Humes is here in the studio. Total Garbage, the book on the table with us. How we can fix our waste and heal our world. Out now with Avery Books. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got Frank behind the glass and Shonda is our studio audience. We'll be back. It's just a fake break. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did. Today on Living Writers, Edward Humes is here. Total Garbage, How We Can Fix Our Waste and Heal Our World, the book on the table with us. Ed, thanks for picking some Bonnie Raitt for today's
yes.
show. Why this song for today?
Well, first of all, I love Bonnie Raitt. I've been a fan for many years and listened to her music. And I like this song that we just heard and it's titled In Nick of Time. And because it applies to so many things going on in our world. And I think changing the narrative on our waste and environment, has to happen, and hopefully it will in the nick of time.
Yes. And that's like your epigrams in the beginning of the, or epigraphs in the beginning of the book, Ed. They're about the time and the time. I don't know. Would you?
It's about, well, really, it's about the antidote to despair is action, you know, and I think where storytellers like us fit in is to sort of provide the narrative of people who are taking action to see if that, can spread like a good cancer.
Yeah, like what you just, yeah, that would be nice if it was good, right? Yeah, and especially it was so inspiring hearing about Ryan Metzger and his son Owen.
Well, like, and his idea just caught on because people heard it and they said, this is so cool, we want to be part of this.
I have a bag of batteries.
I don't know what to do with this darn styrofoam or these plastic bags.
Which is a human thing, isn't it? Like, and we might even have it, like you said, squirreled away in the part of the garage I want to do something with it.
And people want to do good. They want to do the right thing if it's a choice that's available to them. And what Ryan's story is, I'm going to help you do the right thing with this stuff, and it's only going to cost you, you know, $15 a month.
Yeah.
Is it worth it to you? And a lot of people said it is.
Yeah. Well, okay, we're going to get to hear more of the stories inside Total Garbage. But before we do that, your short bio, Ed.
I don't remember what it says, but go for it.
And we can add stuff, too.
Okay, good. Yes.
Edward Humes is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and author whose 16 previous books include Garbology, The Forever Witness, and the Penn Award winning No Matter How Loud I Shout. He lives in Southern California with his human, greyhound, and collie family. So,
can I add to that?
Can we talk about the dogs first? Is okay?
Yeah.
So
always.
you have greyhounds.
Yes, we've been involved with rescue greyhounds for years.
What are your, what greyhounds are in the family now?
Well, right now we have Dottie, who didn't really want to be a racing greyhound, and hence washed out at a fairly young age. So we got her when she was 2.
Ooh, very young.
And she's a very elegant brindle greyhound who used to be a spook, was like afraid of everybody, and now she is the queen of the ball. She she took a while, but she's opened up to the world and is just the bossiest little thing you'll ever want to meet, but in a good way.
How did you decide to rescue and adopt greyhounds?
We went to a we had been interested in sighthounds in general before that, and actually had a Russian wolfhound too. Russian wolfhounds that we adopted. But they're really kind of the rock stars of the hound world. They look like
they should be
the dogs of kings. Well, the Russian wolfhounds are very slender, but they're pretty tall. But we went to an event, an adoption event, and saw some greyhounds that were recently taken from the track and just were smitten with their personalities and their need for a forever home. And we didn't adopt on that day, but we decided that we'd get involved as foster parents, and there were a rescue group, and kind of went from there.
Oh. And you also have a collie.
Also a rescue. When our kids were little, we had a collie that was like having an extra and highly responsible parent in the house. The stories about like Lassie and collie, there's truth to that. And we adopted this wonderful dog who actually appointed himself guardian of our 2 small children and helped my son, for instance, as a toddler, learn to walk by like hanging on to him, and he'd walk along slowly and support our son Eben while he was learning to walk. And he was like always pulling his fur, and I'm sure, you know, it wasn't the most pleasing sensation, but he was so sweet, and he loved our son so much that he happily, you know, was his guide to learning to walk. So things like that. You just, it's such a memory to treasure, and he was a treasure. So, and we found that with our rescues time after time. And right now we have one other greyhound named Finn, and also was a very timid and depressed dog when we got him. He was actually so depressed he was on Prozac, and which I had never heard of for a dog, but he was dejected and despondent, and he had been a coyote dog. Which is apparently, it's an illegal breeding operation. They used them to try and drive off coyotes from areas where ranchers or whatever don't want them.
As a greyhound?
Yeah, well, I mean, it can outrun anything.
They're fast, so. Yeah.
But he, apparently he wasn't very successful at that. And he came to us very emaciated and needed to be socialized and healed and loved. And now he's just doing great. And he's coming off his medication, or has very small doses of it to wean him off. And he's eating and he's playing. And recently he finally barked. And you think, oh, this timid dog's going to have a little squeaker of a bark. He's like, it's this booming basso voice when he finally lets it out, and only when he's happy.
Oh, so and he's getting happier day by day by the sounds of it. So, Ed, I might have this wrong, but when you won the Pulitzer Prize, you were really young. Not that you're not young now.
Well, I am not young now, but yes, it was... I was a little ways into my 30s, I guess. And during my newspaper days.
Yeah.
So I started my professional writing career.
And it feels like, well, what does it feel like to you? Because you can see, like, you can see where you're from in this total garbage book. Like, you can see, like, your... It, like maybe your reporter's eye or your search and for the discovery and you're finding people to talk to. Do you feel like, I don't know, this is,
well, I learned to do that. I learned to do that from my work at newspapers, how to, you know, how to ask the right question and then get the answers and find the story. But it, you know, newspaper writing, news writing of any kind is very formulaic, and it's meant really more as a briefing than a tale. You can get a little bit more of a tale spinning in it, but it's never going to be like a full blown long form narrative, like a book or a long magazine article. And I wanted to transition to that. When that opportunity came along, I thought, well, I'll take a temporary leave. And they finally cleaned out my desk and said, "You're not coming back, are you?" I said, "No, I'm really not." And that's worked out. Well, I'm doing what I love. And, I've come to think that, this form, narrative nonfiction, is really, very vital in the moment that we're living in, because, as a journalist, I was into the investigation and in the revelation and the expose and writing wrongs and accountability journal, and all that is important. And there's elements of that still in what I do, but, a great narrative nonfiction, and I'm not saying I'm great, but I strive to always be better. The very best of it, it's about engine of empathy. I call it the engine of empathy. Instead of the crisis journalism that we've seen so much when we see writing about the climate or the or plastic pollution or anything else off on the world, but what we need is a story that brings people in touch with their common humanity and problem solving together. And I think you do that through character and place and shared experience, and that's what good nonfiction should do, even when it's about trash. And that's what I tried to do.
What you're writing about is so important. It's thank you for doing this work and making it more accessible to more people too.
It's a journey of discovery for me too. I mean,
yes. And it's something you want to do, yeah, right? I imagine just like how, like, I feel like they're my two new favorite people, Ryan and Owen, like Ryan and Owen, but you know how they were like, well, let's track this down. Let's do this. And it's like, it feels like the journey of discovery, like how, what you're finding and what you can empowering.
Actually, what it is you get to meet some really cool people and communities doing really cool things that are making a difference. And here's the insight. So if waste is our big problem, if that's the arch villain of the planet, and everything else, climate and plastic pollution and toxins are all symptoms of that problem. It became easier to find people who are sort of seeing that and addressing it
to listen.
Yeah. So let's talk about food waste and the solution to it. And I'll read a little bit from this chapter in the book called Stick a Fork in It.
Such a great title.
Yeah. I did have fun with the titles. All right. So as soon as he saw that lush front lawn on the corner of Angeles Vista at Olympiad, Jemiah Hargens knew this was the place. The quintessentially Los Angeles stucco home with the red tile roof in the View Park neighborhood was nice enough, but what captivated him was the eye-popping green patch of well-trimmed grass sparkling with morning dew, that time-honored symbol of prosperity, homeowner pride, and humanity's dominion over nature he had been looking for. He pulled over and stared at the lawn, imagining what it would be like to take control of it, this perfect grassy rectangle on this perfect hilly spot, on the perfect LA street, in just the kind of aging but still graceful and diverse neighborhood he had long sought. It would be the culmination of a year of planning, saving, and dreaming. And as he sat parked in front of that lawn, all he could think about was how great it would be to rip it all out, every inch, every blade, every root. Jemiah Hargens dreams of a city with no lawns, and in their place, he sees farms, lots and lots of farms.
I love that.
Well,
and it, you turn things on it, their heads, right? Because you start with the lawn,
yes,
being like this glorious thing, and it is one of those all American type of,
and it is the most wasteful thing we could possibly do, it, particularly in a place like Los Angeles where water is short. It's an incredible waste. It's an ecological desert. There's not a single thing, any honeybee or butterfly. It's like flying over the Sahara Desert to them, because there's nothing there for them. Even though we think it's green and natural, it is anything but. It's an invasive species. It's not even native, the kind of grass, this turf grass.
Right, right. And so how did you find Jemiah Higgins?
Higgins, yeah, yeah. So he founded this nonprofit that I read about called Crop Swap LA. And what he does is he turns lawns into micro farms. And he's got some funding for this and some grants. And he gets people to basically donate their front lawns in exchange for some of the harvest. And the harvest is amazing. He could take 1,000 square foot of grass, you know, just not a great big lawn, you know, not a postage stamp exactly, but, you know, a typical LA-sized lawn. And he can build a solar-powered water-conserving farm there that can produce enough produce, enough fruit and vegetables every week for up to 40 families.
And meanwhile,
40 families off of a lawn.
And meanwhile, the family is still living in the house.
Yes,
and
oh
then
yes.
The micro farm is just their front yard.
The front yard, and it's beautiful. People say, "Oh God, it's going to be an eyesore." People stop driving and say, "What is that? It's amazing because it's lush, beautiful, organically grown vegetables. There's no chemical fertilizers. He recycles the water. It uses about 8%." of the water that a grass lawn used in a much more productive way. And there's all this wasted real estate. And Jemiah says, look, you know, if we had a community that really committed to this and used schoolyards and 20% of the front lawns got people to do this, hunger would be done. And here's the crazy part. It's not expensive to do, especially if you do it by nutritional value. I don't think most people know that an industrial tomato or anything else that's grown on a factory farm, that the way we typically grow and consume vegetables and fruit, can have up to 70 less minerals and vitamins in it than something you can grow in your backyard.
I mean, that's an amazing thing.
It's horrifying. Yeah. The only thing a modern tomato has in it that it didn't 50 years ago is more salt, like 17 times more salt. Just the thing we don't need in our diets, because salt is in everything, like sugar. It's like tasting a different substance when you taste a tomato grown in somebody's backyard or one of these micro farms versus what you can buy at the supermarket. Not only are you saving money and using the environment in a responsible way and alleviating what Jemiah calls food apartheid, because he's doing this in food deserts in Los Angeles, where access to fresh vegetables and produce is very scant. But you're also just getting something that tastes better. And it's fun. Anybody can do some version of this. It doesn't have to be high tech. You know, during World War II, when much of our nation's produce was diverted to support the war effort and being sent overseas, because, you know, 1 in 8 living Americans served in the military during World War II. It was big time. And so there was this campaign to grow victory gardens, they were called. And within 2 years, we went from basically zero or insignificant percentage of our food supply coming from people's, you know, backyard gardens or front yard gardens to 40% of our produce and fruit, vegetables, 40%. So it's not like a drop in the bucket.
Right.
And people just did this voluntarily. If there was actually support for this kind of conversion and a community said, yeah, let's go all in on this, it would be transformative. And you think, well, it won't be as efficient. It'll be more wasteful to do it this way. No. Our industrial agriculture system is so wasteful, it has to be heavily subsidized just to keep it afloat.
Is Jemiah finding that people like this is catching on? Like, is this, when we're looking at these different stories, like we could see how Ridwell could go across the country. Is this crop swap? Is this happening?
This concept is being replicated. It needs more funding. It does. Because the startup cost is the thing. Once it's up and running, it's pretty self-sustaining, but establishing it and staffing it is a cost. So he's gotten some grants for that, and it could certainly be expanded much more rapidly and widely than it has been.
And we could start more simply, like the Victory Gardens.
Yeah.
And
that has picked up. Actually, since the pandemic, people started, or during the pandemic, people actually made this something they wanted to do, and are keeping it because because it's amazing once you do it. It's not hard.
What was the thing that was like the maybe one of the most surprising things that you found as you were going on this like journey of discovery?
It was that really amazing things on the sustainability and environmental front are happening in places where you wouldn't expect it. And I did. I have to confess, I deliberately looked for places, not just in blue state America, but in red state America, where amazing things are happening. And again, it gets back to this question of, well, if you reframe things like, and unfortunately divisive things like climate change or electrification of our cars or renewable energy, all those have become hot button political issues. But if you make the conversation about, well, we got to get the waste out of our system, well, that's something anybody can kind of get their heads around and say, well, I don't really care about trying to reduce climate change, or I don't believe in all that stuff, or whatever. They do want to be efficient and less wasteful and save money. Farmers want to maximize their profits and be more productive and not waste their resources. And the great thing about sustainability is that all those things usually align. It's not more costly to be less wasteful and more sustainable. It's less costly. It pencils out. And that's why the number one renewably powered state in the country right now, and has been for years, is Iowa. If it was a country, it would be the second most renewable country in the world. Yeah. Wow. Right.
Wow. That's well done, Iowa.
It's on any given day, over 2/3 of their power is generated primarily by wind. And the farmers are, and I talked to some of these farmers, they formed co-ops to finance building windmills on their cornfields and their other fields. And they just grow right around it, you know.
Why not?
And why not? And so they harvest the wind. It's the most reliable crop they've got because it pays off. And they have extremely low electrical power, and they own it. It's theirs. And it's a model that works. And why would somebody who could tap into this resource not do it? It's so efficient because once you build it, there's no recurring fuel cost. You know, once you go down the fossil fuel route, you're addicted to life. You will always have to fill up the tank. And that's why it becomes so wasteful and so costly, and why renewable power, notwithstanding some of the rhetoric we're hearing now, is the least expensive power available anywhere. And the rest of the world knows this. Bill McKibben was just talking about this the other day in celebration of a new day honoring solar energy. He's trying to start up on September 21st, Sunday, a compliment to Earth Day. And
wonderful.
Yeah. And the idea, unfortunately, that he is forced to admit to is that the country that invented solar technology, the United States, is the laggard on actually using it, and China is leading the world forward. And as someone who I shan't name might say, that's sad. I got to tell you that when I see
state like Iowa, or the town of Morris, Minnesota, which is the most renewable, sustainable farm town in America. They're not just using solar everything. And this is, you know, an area that was 20 plus points for President Trump in the election. They have solar powered buses, solar powered and geothermal heated public buildings. Even the liquor store has great big solar arrays on the roof. This is in Minnesota. And their motto is, "We chill your beer with the sun."
Right.
And who doesn't want that? Well, they all want it. So all these other farm towns see, wow, can we have some of this too? And the next thing they want to do, if the grants still come through, is to make green ammonia, which is used for fertilizer in industrial agriculture, or most agriculture in the world, is incredibly carbon intensive to make the traditional way, but is totally carbon free if you make it with renewable energy, which they have an abundance of. They make them more than they can use. So if they can make locally produced green fertilizer that has no carbon emissions, it's incredibly cheap, and is right in their backyard instead of having the stuff trained in or trucked in to fertilize the farms, it's a win all around. And yeah, it's good for the climate too, but that doesn't have to even be part of the conversation if they don't want it to be. It still makes sense to do things this way, the green way, the sustainable way, the zero waste way.
And that's why your book is like how we can fix our waste and heal our world.
Because we can.
Like heal our world.
Will we is
and
the question.
And our communities. Yeah, will we? And why?
And why wouldn't we? I mean, that's the kind of, you know, I say, okay, don't despair. We could do it, and that means someday we're gonna do it.
Yes, yes.
But it's easy to feel despair sometimes, and this book really, for me, was kind of the cure, because finding out these things really makes me very hopeful.
Thanks for writing it, Ed. Because it scared me at first, for sure.
Well, I did that on purpose, just to get you in the door.
I mean, that is actually a quick writing note to everyone out there, just so you can, before you get your copy, run out and get one. Prologue, the credit card, the first line, standalone, you swallowed 285 pieces of plastic today. That's the first sentence.
Yeah.
And then you will do it again tomorrow and the next day and the next. That's your second sentence. It's a lot, but it's hopeful. And these people, the stories that you tell in this of these real life kind of ordinary people doing extraordinary things, it could be anyone. You don't have to be passive. You don't have to feel overwhelmed. You can make a start.
Well, you know, and I collected from all different people, political activists, home cooks, you name it, who have suggestions on how we can consume less plastic, or, you know, be more sustainable. There's the great thing about waste is it's the one problem anyone can do something about. I mean, it just you know, could be something as simple as, hey, you don't need to put saran wrap on that bowl of salad. Just put a plate on top of it. You know, save your peanut butter jar and put stuff in that. It can be that simple. And I love that. And I have a lot, I put a big list of that thing, and I can't say I thought of them all, but I found people who have. And
yeah, there's a master list in the back, what you can do right now about waste, just something.
Or food waste, you know, instead of throwing out the carrot tops and all the other things that we think is the inedible part, make soup. You know, soup is the perfect food because nothing gets wasted. And you can make a big pot of it and have home-cooked meals, healthy meals, meal soups, you know, hearty ones, for days. So it's a labor saver, too.
Look at this.
I'm a soup lover, boy. It's like one of the most sustainable foods there is.
Well, on that note, Ed, thank you so much for talking today, for this conversation. And thank you so much for writing Total Garbage, How We Can Fix Our Waste and Heal Our World. This is an important book. It's a hopeful book. Thanks for today.
Thank you, T.
And thanks to the Institute for the Humanities for bringing you here to campus. Much thanks to Shonda for literally bringing you here to the studio. and organizing the public events and the talks. And thanks to Frank Yulee for engineering. Thanks everyone out there for listening. And good luck. We can do it. Renew, repurpose, recycle. Have a vision. We can do it. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks for listening to Mom. Bye, everyone.
Watch the flowers grow.
Watch them grow.
Watch the flowers grow.
Watch them grow.
Watch the flowers grow.
Watch them grow.
Watch the flowers grow.
Your everyone who follows me today. I'll show you places where flowers grow on top of last year's fallen snow. For everyone who follows me today. Can't stop the flowers.
To another episode of Daily Sports Talk on WCBN Radio. Today we have a very interesting panel, very good variety. We have Bowen, Max, Vihan, and just yeah, start it off. How are we doing today, guys?
Good.
Solid.
Yeah, so, yeah, obviously, I just want to start the show off some positive vibes. You know, before we get into the main topic, you know, what's wrong with the Philadelphia Eagles? But to start off with, what were some positives, you know, your guys' week?
The Cowboys lost to the Panthers and the Commanders lost to the Bears. Both fan bases deserve this, by the way. They were absolutely twerking all over the internet after the Eagles lost to the Giants on Thursday, only to get belted by Caleb Williams and Bryce Young, who are both looking like good quarterbacks, might I add. But yeah, just absolutely hilarious. Both fan bases absolutely deserve this.
Valid.
In addition to the Giants winning, which I guess we'll get into in a little bit, I spent 2 days in Rhode Island, so that was really nice. And I saw a movie last night that I really enjoyed, so that was great.
Yeah, got to head home over fall break, visit Slippery Rock for a bit, and Steelers even kept up their streak, 22 years of dominance against the Browns at home in the regular season. So
has it really been 22 years since the Browns won in Pittsburgh?
No, they won
regular season.
They won the playoffs.
Regular season. It's been since 2003. They haven't won. Tim Couch.
Nice. Shout out Tim Couch. So that's and kind of hop right into this. Obviously we've seen the Philadelphia Eagles drop now 2 straight games. Offensive struggles have been key.